From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Iraq has begun withdrawing its troops from the Kuwait border. Does that mean the crisis is over? On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Fred Halliday, professor of international relations at the London School of Economics. Also today, 50 days of solitude. At the age of 75, writer Doris Grumbach tried an experiment. She spent 50 days alone in her house in Maine. She'll tell us about her brief retreat from the world. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Liz Phair. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Kuwait's information minister says there still hasn't been a total withdrawal of Iraq's Republican Guard from areas near Kuwait's border. He says a way must be found to keep those forces away permanently. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports from Kuwait City.
Kuwaiti Information Minister Sheikh Saud Nasser al-Sabah says while some Iraqi units have moved away from the Kuwaiti border, the situation is still not back to the status quo that existed before this past week's crisis began. He stressed the need for a lasting block to Iraqi belligerents.
We cannot and will not rest assured until proper arrangements have been made through the Security Council to disallow Iraqi troops from coming to a certain point in the south. Therefore, it's important for us that we are not going to have to go through this again and again every couple of months.
The information minister said at the very least, some kind of buffer zone has to be created beyond which Iraqi troops will not be allowed to go. I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Kuwait City.
Haiti's former military ruler says he hopes to find tranquility and peace in Panama. General Raul Cedras and his family arrived in Panama City this morning after leaving Port-au-Prince overnight. He thanked Panama and told reporters that his family was going through a difficult time. It's not known how long they will remain in Panama. The return of exiled President Jean-Bertrand Aristide is now clear. He's expected to fly home on Saturday. The Palestinian extremist group Hamas says today a kidnapped Israeli soldier is alive and well, but it repeated its threat to kill the soldier if Israel does not meet its demands. NPR's Paul Miller reports from Jerusalem.
The latest communique from Hamas says Nachshon Waxman is still alive but is not necessarily being held in Gaza. An advisor to PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat, Ahmed Tibi, said much the same thing. Tibi is reported to be trying to negotiate Waxman's release through international agencies and an unnamed foreign government. And Palestinian police in Gaza have conducted the largest search and arrest operation since Palestinian self-rule began last spring. They've taken in more than 200 suspected extremists for questioning. Both Israel and the United States say they hold Arafat responsible for the safety of Waxman, who holds joint U.S. and Israeli citizenship. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
The Labor Department reports inflation at the producer level fell 0.5% last month. That's the biggest drop in a year. It could relieve investors who've been worried about inflation. The decline in the producer price index reflects drops in gas and other energy prices, along with a big fall in the price of coffee. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 16 points at 3,891. This is NPR. Negotiations between the Denver teachers and the school board have resumed in the Colorado governor's office. Talks have produced agreement on several issues. Governor Roy Romer intervened in the contract dispute yesterday after a Denver judge refused a state request to order the teachers back to work. The judge says the teachers are public employees and have the right to strike. Public school officials say about 20,000 of the 63,000 students weren't in school yesterday. That is three times the normal absentee rate. Several drug companies are the focus of a federal probe. Government regulators are investigating whether the companies used improper incentives to induce doctors or pharmacists to prescribe their drugs. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The government is looking into whether drug companies use illegal kickbacks, cash payments, and million-dollar grants to induce doctors and pharmacists to promote the use of their drugs. Officials from several federal agencies are urging a House subcommittee to broaden its powers to fight the criminal activities and to monitor practices that lead to some patients taking drugs they don't need. The panel yesterday focused its attention on the controversial human growth hormone Protropin. The panel heard testimony from Benjamin Dobrin of Minneapolis, who accused his doctor of wrongful treatment for prescribing Protropin. Dobrin says he didn't need the drug and it cost him $30,000 a year and his family their health insurance. His doctor is now under indictment for accepting drug company kickbacks. The manufacturer of the drug, Genentech, has issued a statement saying the company's programs have been in the interest of good public health. The Food and Drug Administration, Justice Department, and Federal Health Inspector General say they're investigating numerous promotions in addition to Genentech. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
Elderly Americans with broken bones will now be able to use a new way to speed up the healing process. The Sonic Accelerated Fracture Healing System has been given the green light by the Food and Drug Administration. It uses ultrasound to speed up the healing process. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Some Iraqi troops have retreated from the border with Kuwait, but the U.S. is going forward with its military buildup in the Gulf. Today, the U.S. started military exercises in Kuwait. My guest Fred Halliday has been following this new Gulf crisis. Halliday is a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics. He's also a contributing editor to the Middle East Report in Washington, D.C., and a senior fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, also in Washington. Halliday is the author of several books on the Mideast, including Arabs in Exile. We called him earlier today at his home in London and asked if he thinks Iraq's retreat means that the crisis is over.
I doubt it. First of all, the whole issue that underlies it, namely the UN sanctions policy, Saddam's interpretation of it, the Americans' interpretation of it, that question has certainly not been resolved, and as long as there is this impasse, which really has gone on since the end of the war in early 1991, there is room for further contradictions, further conflicts. But I think even this phase of the crisis, this chapter, if you like, which may be a matter of weeks or months, is not over. Saddam took the initiative to mobilize the troops of the south. He must have known it would produce a response. So the question is, I mean, rather like looking at a chessboard, what was he hoping to do after that? And I see two possibilities. One is that he will have a crack at the north. The area in the north, which is the safe haven for the Kurds, not in good shape because it too is subject to the UN sanctions. So the economic situation is bad. There's been fighting between the Kurds. The Turks on the north of this area are getting increasingly worried about it and want it more or less wrapped up. So Saddam may try and do something against the north. I mean, he's been probing, assassinating, and so on, but he may try and do more. And that would be a much more difficult test of Western response and of Clinton's policy than the thing on Kuwait.
Why would it be more difficult?
Well, first of all, the Kuwait issue looks clear. It looks like here's an independent state which Saddam is threatening and so forth, and the people fought for it in 91. They'll fight for it again. The Kurdish area is part of Iraq. The West does not support a separate Kurdish state there. Nobody's fought for it. In fact, they've been reluctant to do so. And moreover, the Turks would not make it easy for anyone to intervene there. I think the other possibility is he'll try something diplomatic. He's been talking about recognizing Kuwait as a kind of peace offensive, and he might do it. He might play this card sometime in the next few weeks, even if it doesn't get him very far. But I've long thought that he's got another option, which would be very dramatic if he could pull it off, which would be some kind of public alliance with Iran. Up to now, he and Iran have kept shy of each other. They're both under the American so-called dual containment policy, and both have tried to wriggle out of the dual containment policy by saying, well, the other guy's worse than us. You know, Saddam said the Iranians are worse than us. The Iranians say he's worse than us. But if, as there are some indications, he's going to warm up his relation with the Iranians, they could both say, America should get out of the Gulf. We represent the majority of the peoples here. We're going to bust the embargo together. And this would have quite a detonating effect. Now, whether the mullahs in Tehran and Saddam can actually find a common ground or choose to do so, I'm not sure. But they've been hinting at improving relations. And this would be a kind of, you know, you might call it a devil's pact in the sense they hate each other. But it would certainly undercut American policy in the whole region.
So tell me more about how you interpret the motivation for, you know, Saddam Hussein's motivation for sending troops to the Kuwait border.
Well, you've got to look at it on several levels. First of all, he is very angry at the UN's maintenance of sanctions. He says, we've complied since November 1993 with the provisions of Resolution 687 on the monitoring of our weapons programs. And the UN Inspector Ekios has to some extent confirmed that. But of course, in saying that, Saddam is focusing everything on the military provisions of Resolution 687 and its successor, 688. And the texts are clear. There are other conditions, political conditions, such as recognizing the sovereignty of Kuwait, such as accounting for some Kuwaiti prisoners of war, 600 civilian military who got lost in the war, such as having some kind of dialogue with the political other political forces in Iraq. So by narrowing it to the military issue, he's in a sense, you know, trying to define it most favorably to him. But he's also highlighting what is a fact and is being pushed out into the open now, which is that as long as he's there, and as long as a regime like his is there, the United States is going to oppose lifting of the sanctions. And I don't personally believe they were ever going to be lifted. Whatever the French or the Russians did in the UN Security Council, they weren't going to pick a huge row with Washington for the sake of Saddam. But Saddam has made another calculation, and again, not a totally inaccurate one, which is although his prestige as the great Arab nationalist leader has declined substantially in the Middle East, basically because he lost, he blew it, in 1991, there is a lot of sympathy for Iraq. Iraq's a very important Arab country. It's got a very important place in Arab history, in the history of Arab nationalism, in Arab literature, and so on. And many people in the Arab world and in Iran and Turkey feel the Iraqi people have been punished enough, whatever they think of Saddam. And in a sense, he's playing on that issue. He's got Iran says the sanctions should be lifted. Turkey says the sanctions should be lifted. The Jordanians say the sanctions should be lifted. So there is a broad sympathy there for lifting the sanctions, which he's appealed to.
You think this is a way that he can try to rally support?
Yeah, I think he can rise to it and say, basically, it's the Americans' fault. Mm-hmm. And moreover, they are playing, they're moving the goalposts. And, of course, he says that because he's saying the argument is just about military supervision. And to be fair to the UN resolutions, they're not just about military supervision. They're about other things. But he thinks that he's made major concessions. They've not been met by the outside world. So he's got to show his own people he means business, play on regional sensibility, and also get, you know, Clinton to spend a few billion dollars flying all his troops out to the area and flying them back again. And how often is he going to wind them up and down is something which, of course, people will ask.
You know, Norman Schwarzkopf said that he thinks the explanation for Saddam Hussein's behavior is the Jimmy Carter factor, that Saddam Hussein thinks, well, if I really start acting up, they'll send Jimmy Carter down and I'll be able to get a better deal with Jimmy Carter negotiating than I will with the UN. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that's U.S. domestic politics. I mean, I don't think Schwarzkopf is a politician, and he's a military man, and I don't think, frankly, he knows what he's talking about any more than Ross Perot knows what he's talking about. The fact is, a lot of scorn has been, I mean, just to wrap this one, or go around this one for a moment, actually, by all accounts, talking today, Carter carried out a very significant mission in Haiti, which was cunningly done, well done, and has turned out to be successful and saved a lot of life and blood, and all power to him, that's what he did. But General Cedras is a much weaker person and a much more amenable person than Saddam. So Carter wasn't going to go to Baghdad. I mean, if Schwarzkopf had said Ramsey Clark, maybe, but Ramsey Clark, frankly, made a complete fool of himself during the Gulf War and the negotiations before it, and Carter is not Ramsey Clark. So I don't think that, I think it's denigrating what Carter tried to do. And in this case, the Americans did, I think, a much more sensible thing in Haiti than Schwarzkopf would have advised. But in this case, there's nothing to negotiate. I mean, lots of people have been to Saddam. I mean, I know people who've known Saddam for years, who've gone and seen him, who've talked to him before the war, after the war, recently. Basically, he's not listening. He's living in a fantasy world of his own, not a totally irrational one, but a fantasy world of his own. And he still thinks that, you know, he can push and push and get away with it. And in that sense, he's miscalculated. But he has some room for maneuver, and he's willing to go on doing these things as long as it takes.
How would you compare President Clinton's handling so far of the crisis in Iraq with the way President Bush handled it when Iraqi troops massed at the Kuwaiti border?
Well, at one level, the response has been much quicker, but then it was easy for it to be so. First of all, Clinton didn't have a Democratic opposition saying, don't do it. I mean, Clinton, for once, had the Republicans on his side, and the Republicans so far have not tried to make capital out of it. So the domestic U.S. political situation, the congressional situation, was much easier. Secondly, the instruments were in place. I mean, you don't need another U.N. resolution to defend Kuwait. They've got pre-positioned equipment there. There's a lot of the allies are in place, although they kick and scream. I mean, the French protest, but they nevertheless send military support. Moreover, there's no need to negotiate with Saddam in terms of Western public opinion. I mean, he's denying the sovereignty of Kuwait, and people are saying, well, Kuwait's got a right. It may be an artificial state, but then so is Iraq, so it's got a right to exist, not be invaded. So in that sense, it's much easier for him. But if, going back to where we began, this particular bit of the crisis isn't over, let alone the whole story, then it's too early to say. I mean, what he does now is quite difficult. And, of course, what he does in response to what Saddam might do, another punch to the north or a diplomatic offensive or something, remains to be seen.
My guest is Fred Halliday. He's a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Middle East expert Fred Halliday. What are the options now that the UN has?
Well, the UN could or could have decided to accept Saddam's interpretation of the resolutions and say he's agreeing to supervision, let's lift the sanctions, or let's do it more gradually. Let's, A, have a timetable for lifting sanctions. Say we'll start in 6 months' time. You know, Iraq could export oil up to, you know, let's say $5 billion, and then later 10, and then whatever else they can get, sort of thing, up to a putative total of 15, or whatever they think they're going to get from their full oil exports. So they could have softened, but of course that's become less likely. But the long-run situation, it's a stalemate. It's been a stalemate since February the 28th, 1991. And as long as the U.S. maintains its policy with the support of many countries, including Saudi Arabia, as long as Saddam is there, it is a stalemate. And both sides are waiting for the other to crack. Well, I don't think the West is going to crack. Frankly, the West might keep on sanctions for another 20 years. After how long do they keep sanctions on North Korea or Cuba? Indeed, Saddam, looking around, might think the best way to stay in power is to have sanctions. So look how long Kim and Sung and Castro stayed in power. And on the other hand, Iraq may change. There have been several coup attempts, two at least of which I think were genuine, serious ones. Reports of others are less clear. But you can't have coup attempts every week any more than you could in Nazi Germany. And maybe, you know, the number of people willing to risk their lives has been used up. So Saddam might be there for a long time. So it's a stalemate, essentially.
This crisis is happening during the Middle East peace process. How has the peace process affected how other Arab countries are reacting to Saddam's behavior?
Well, it's a complicated question. First of all, Saddam's prestige is much lower. There's much less enthusiasm throughout the Arab world for what he's doing. I think that's important, including, by all accounts, among Palestinians, even those strongly opposed to the peace process. So there's a kind of bit of delinking taking place. Secondly, the Americans are seen by some of the conservative Arab states as having at least delivered on part of what they promised back in 1990-91. I would say, not to be misunderstood, but the part of the historic credit, not the moral credit, but the historic credit for getting the Arab-Israeli peace process goes to Saddam. He gave everyone a big shock, including the Israelis. I mean, I think Israeli self-confidence has been eroded by a number of things. The Intifada is one thing. I think before that, very not to be forgotten, the war in Lebanon in 1982, and they realized they couldn't just do everything they wanted to do. But having missiles rain down on you and having to all resort to wearing gas masks and so on is something which I think hit the Israeli population. I mean, they realized they have military superiority, but they have to, you know, they have to deal with a security threat that can't be dealt with by purely territorial acquisitions.
Jordan has condemned Iraq's aggressive behavior. The PLO is not supporting Saddam Hussein. Do you think that that Jordan and the PLO would have been reacting in the same way if it weren't for the Middle East peace process?
No, I think, I mean, to put it very harshly, Jordan and the PLO have got Saddam from Saddam what they wanted. Namely, he gave the United States a kick in the backside and got it to finally do something about this Arab-Israeli peace process and gave them a real fright. And so Iraq hasn't benefited, but others have. And And secondly, they realized that Saddam, while he may have had some right on his side or some arguments on his side in 1990, has much less now. And also Jordan can see trouble coming. I mean, one of the problems Jordan has, and the Kuwait has, everybody has, and most of all the people of Iraq have, is what comes after Saddam. I mean, the country's being run down in a very drastic way, and that will greatly accentuate the problems thereafter. And if you're on the frontier, as Jordan is, and if much of your economic livelihood is dependent upon trade with Iraq, then this is a serious consideration. So King Hussein, I mean, played the 1990-91 crisis very shrewdly, but he is pretty fed up with Saddam now, and I think has made that clear. And he's another one of the people who's been to Saddam and said, come on, you know, shape up, the world isn't like this, we can help you out of this, and Saddam hasn't listened to him.
How has Saddam Hussein managed to stay in power?
By shooting people. I think it has to, I mean, one of the arguments, you know, that came up during the last Gulf War was, why should we defend Kuwait or Saudi Arabia, which are dictatorships just like Saddam? But I mean, it's a gruesome thing to do, but if you quantify human rights violations or have any criteria of relative tyranny or dictatorship, there's no comparison between even a pretty grotesque conservative state, particularly for women, like Saudi Arabia and Iraq. I mean, Saddam has murdered hundreds of thousands of his own people. He's gassed them. He's destroyed 8,000 villages. I mean, one just has to look, you read cold-bloodedly the annual reports of Amnesty International, there is no comparison between the human rights record of Saudi Arabia and the human rights record of Iraq. And he has maintained in power in that way. Secondly, he has a clique of people around him from his own area, who enough of the population to staff the key military units. For a long time, he had oil, which he spent in a quite shrewd political way. And people were frightened. They were frightened of Iran. I mean, one of the whole paradoxes of the story is that when they were in a war with Iran for 8 years and Iran appealed to Muslim rebellion in Iraq and so on, the Iraqi people rallied to Saddam, and they rallied on the basis of what one could call very roughly an Iraqi patriotism, which many people had doubted was there. But when Saddam went into Kuwait and was driven out by the Americans, the Iraqi people didn't rally to him. They rose up in an insurrection in which many, many more people were killed than were killed in the war with the Americans in 1991. So he's lost a lot of that support, but people I've talked to come from Iraq are still frightened about what will happen afterwards. Will they just fall apart like Afghanistan or Lebanon or Somalia? But the main thing is fear and terror. And I remember when I was in Iraq meeting somebody who said to me, as a kind of joke, but it wasn't, he was an academic, he said, you know, when I open the newspapers in the morning, I don't know if I will have been nominated ambassador to the UN or sentenced to death. And in either case, I wouldn't know why. And I think, you know, the arbitrary executions are continuing, but if you're prepared to be tough enough and if you have enough of a group of people around you, it's very hard to be displaced. And the fact is, the Iraqi people did rise up in 91, North and South, Arab and Kurd, Sunni and Shia. There were vast mutinies in the army in the South. He crushed them. And people won't try it again lightly, inevitably.
Saddam Hussein recently instituted the Islamic punishment of cutting off a hand for theft, and he warned deserters from the armed forces that they risked losing both ears.
Yes, this is, I mean, there's several aspects of this. One is that he is and has been trying to deck himself out in Islamic garb by claiming to be a descendant of the Prophet and building, he's planning now to build a huge mosque in Baghdad. Even while his people are starving, he's ordered $25 million worth of marble from Italy and all the rest of it. But, I mean, nobody really believes that he has Islamic legitimacy. In that sense, it's a forlorn activity. But this thing of physical executions is part of his belief that if you want to rule a country, you should rule it harshly. He's not only said that, he said that doctors who refuse to carry out these amputations will themselves have the amputations performed on them that they refuse to perform on others. In other words, if you're a doctor and you're told to cut off the ears of a deserter and you don't do it, then you'll have your own ears cut off. And I remember once arguing with a leading member of Saddam's party, and I said, you know, why are you so cruel? Why do you kill and torture so many people? And he didn't say what people in many countries say was, we're not doing it, this is imperialist lies. He said, yes, we do it. We do kill and torture people, but we have to. He used the Arabic word giswa, meaning harshness. You need a giswa to run a country like Iraq, to make it a great nation, and Saddam really believes that.
Do you think Iraqi expansionism is a threat to Middle East peace?
Well, Iraqi expansionism has been a threat to two other Muslim countries, namely Iran, whom he attacked in 1980, and Kuwait, which he attacked in 1990. It's possible that he could one day, if he was able, have a crack at Syria, and it's also possible that he'd gobble up Jordan, but I don't think you'll get the chance to do either of those things. I don't think that Iraq's policies are capable of scuppering the Arab-Israeli peace negotiations. I think they have other problems, which we've seen in the last few days. But I know what's wrong with the Arab-Israeli peace negotiation, and anybody, Israeli or Palestinian, will tell you what's wrong with them. And the end, of, and it's in particular, they're keeping the Palestinians under a very tight and, in many ways, humiliating control. But I'm still of the view, which I know many critics of the agreement in the Middle East and in the United States are not, I'm still of the view that this is a positive development. It can be made to go forward, although it'll be stopped on occasion. And that people who are broadly sympathetic to a kind of understanding between Palestinians and Israelis should try and push it forward. I do not think one should go around denouncing and carping this agreement, as quite a lot of sincere, but in my view misguided and actually irresponsible Arab and American intellectuals have done over the last two or three years. I just don't think that's a very positive contribution to actually helping the Palestinians. So I think the thing is running, albeit in a very messy way. I was in Israel in June and talked to a lot of Palestinians and Israelis when I was there. I must say the most encouraging thing of all was talking to settlers, because Israeli settlers, because they all thought they were finished. I mean, their only hope was if Saddam, was if Hafez al-Assad, the president of Syria, refused to do a deal on the Golan, and then Rabin would fall, and then the Likud, the right-wing party, would come to power and the peace process would be over. But, I mean, everybody was complaining, and the Palestinian complaints, both vis-a-vis the Israelis and vis-a-vis Arafat, are perfectly understandable. But the fact is something had changed, and I think it should be taken forward. And so far it's kept on moving, if in an odd way. There are immense problems, but let's have the problems of peace rather than the problems of total hatred, genocide, and refugee status and all the rest of it.
Do you think Arab countries are really reconciled to the existence of Israel?
I've been traveling in the Arab world for more than 20 years, and I am struck. I'm struck every day by the shift in attitude, whether it's at the level of what you read in newspapers or what political leaders say, or just the way people talk about Israel. I mean, they're critical of Israel, they disagree with it, they say that it's been indulged by America, it's, and so on and so on, but they talk about it as if it's another country in the region. They don't like Israel, there'll always be problems, but I think we're in a totally different situation from what we were in 5, 10, 15 years ago. That stalemate is broken, and among Palestinians also, and people are saying, how do we live with these, with this state, rather than how do we get rid of it? And that's a huge shift, and I think a very positive one.
Fred Halliday. He's a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics and a contributing editor of the Middle East Report. He spoke to us from London. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. French leaders say the international community must put Iraq on probation. The comments come a day after they question the motives behind the U.S. military buildup in the Persian Gulf. From Paris, Lynn Terry has more.
Foreign Minister Alain Juppé indicated in a speech to the Senate that even if Iraq pulls its troops back, that France will not support a gradual lifting of sanctions. Before this crisis, the French government had favored moving in that direction. Now Juppé said Iraq has lost a lot of time and ground. He said the international community will have to verify if Baghdad has returned to being cooperative. In a separate statement, Juppé's spokesman also tried to smooth over differences with the United States. Yesterday, the defense minister said Iraq had not violated any Security Council resolutions. Juppé's spokesman said even if that's technically true, that Iraq had violated the spirit of the resolutions. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Swiss officials say the body of the leader of the cult at the center of the 53-death mystery has been found. Officials say Luc Jouret's body has been identified among 25 charred corpses that were found in a chalet in the village of Grange-sur-Salvan. The announcement ends an international search for him. Authorities had issued an arrest warrant for Jouret after they found evidence suggesting he might have killed cult members in Switzerland and Canada. President Clinton has signed into law the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act. It's supposed to improve how the federal government purchases items and at the same time saves taxpayers more than $12 billion over the next 5 years. The president says the changes will require the government to get better value for taxpayers' dollars.
This procurement reform legislation we are signing today is a way to build the confidence of the American people in government, but also empower the people who work for the government to make the most of their jobs and make the most of taxpayers' dollars. This is the kind of thing I'm convinced that we'll be called upon to do more and more. Not to do things for people, but to empower people to do things for themselves, both within and beyond the government.
The Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act is part of Vice President Gore's National Performance Review. It's designed to overhaul the federal government's cumbersome procurement system. Much of southeastern Georgia is troubled by floodwater. 10 inches of rain fell in some areas. Savannah has been hit hard, with more than 100 streets closed by high water. Hundreds of people have been forced to evacuate their homes. Firefighters have rescued dozens of Savannah residents with rafts. An unexpected drop in producer prices drove stocks higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 15 points to end the day at 3,889. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-2 in heavy trading. This is NPR. The Bread for the World Institute has released its annual report on world hunger, showing declines in Asia but increases in Africa and the United States. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
The Institute says the hunger problem in the Asia-Pacific region is improving because of economic growth and public investments in nutrition. But the gains there are more than offset by the growing problems in sub-Saharan Africa. Here in the U.S., Bread for the World says an estimated 30 million people can't afford enough food to maintain good health, and nearly a quarter of children are living below the poverty line. The group's president, David Beckman, says it's time for lawmakers and voters to recognize that there's a link between hunger and violence.
Part of the solution is values, family values, yes, but also values at the community, the national, and the international level.
Beckman says increased funding for programs like WIC, the assistance program for women, infants, and children, could end widespread hunger in just a few years. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
The Nobel Prize for Literature has been awarded to Japanese novelist Kenzaburo Oni. The Swiss Prize Committee is honoring him for what they cite as his poetic force. The committee points to his 1967 novel, The Silent City, that deals with people's relationships in a world, quote, where knowledge, passion, dreams, ambition, and attitudes merge into each other. The political wing of the Irish Republican Army is welcoming a ceasefire that has been declared by pro-British Protestant paramilitary groups, but the British government is more cautious. The ceasefire is scheduled to take effect at midnight local time. This comes 6 weeks after the IRA declared its own truce. The Protestant paramilitaries apologized for the hundreds of deaths they've caused. They say they'll hold their fire for as long as the IRA does. They're blamed for many of the deaths in Northern Ireland's 25 years of guerrilla warfare. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Have you ever wondered what it would be like to be completely alone for an extended period of time? Would you get to know yourself better? And would you like what you found? At the age of 75, writer Doris Grumbach decided to try it. In the winter of 93, while her companion Sybil was out of town on business, Grumbach stayed alone at their home in Maine. For 50 days, Grumbach saw no friends, stayed away from the telephone, and virtually retreated from the world. Her new memoir is called 50 Days of Solitude. Grumbach is the author of two other memoirs and eight novels. You may also remember her book reviews on NPR's Morning Edition. She told me she'd spent very little time alone in her life.
I was alone once when my husband was drafted, and I was alone again when we separated. But my life, all 76 years of it, was filled with people. When I was in a family of people, when I went to college, when I worked in New York at various jobs, when I married and had quite a lot of children, it was always populated with people. So this was really the first extended time that I had to seek out what it was I wanted to find.
Did you set certain rules for yourself during your time alone?
Well, I made a schedule. I decided I would get up very early and work until I got tired, and then I wouldn't allow big blocks of doing nothing to happen. In a recent review of this book in the New York Times by a very perspicacious reviewer, she says that the reading that I did was cheating. And I thought about that after I read the review, and I decided that it wasn't. What the reading was, and that was how I spent the time almost every afternoon reading a book, what the reading was listening to other voices, filling the silence with the voice on the page.
You write that at first it was very exhilarating to not hear any other voices because there was no one else around, so you were compelled to listen more intently to your own inner voice. What was that experience like?
Well, you do listen. It's a curious kind of thing. You're not conscious of your inner self surrounded by people. You're not conscious of it if the radio is playing all the time or the television is on, or even, I think, if music is on all the time, much as I would like that to be so. What you are conscious of is this self, this inner core of being, and you listen to that, and it's sometimes frightening. Sometimes there's nothing there, and you think, there is nothing there. I'm the missing person. But other times, you hear things which you might not have heard in this isolation and this solitude.
Now, you write in your book about your 50 Days of Solitude that you found yourself thinking a lot about getting older, thinking a lot about death. Did you think about it more than usual?
Yes, that was something I noticed, that the silence is almost a precursor, I think, to the ultimate silence. And you do think more about the long loneliness, as Dorothy Day calls it, the long loneliness of the final silence. When you're alone, there's no distraction from those thoughts, and so you tend to dwell on them, to wonder whether it will be like this, except without consciousness. I think it's true that as you get older, you tend to speak less, you tend to listen more, you tend to think about the end more constantly.
What's healthy and what's unhealthy about the amount of time that you spent thinking of death?
I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about death. I spent a lot of time thinking about what makes a person. Who was I? Was I a well-supplied, well-stocked mind that could sustain me until the end of my life? or was I just a layer upon layer of being that had been provided to me by my parents and my friends and my critics and the people around me? My thoughts on myself became very intense and probably not terribly healthy, because there's more of you there alone than there would be if you had some other outlets.
You know, I think often when people grow older, one of the things they want to do is make every moment count as much as they can. And did you ever feel that, well, by sentencing yourself to 50 days of solitude, you were both gaining something, but you were losing something too. You were losing 50 days of contact with other people, 50 days of contact with your partner, for instance. But you would have spoken on the phone more, right, if you hadn't kind of set these guidelines for yourself, right?
Did I lose anything? I don't think so. In living as long as I have stocked up on so much to think about, so much to remember, so many people I've known, so many books I've read, so much music I've heard, that if I heard nothing more and saw no one else, I would still feel that I was occupied. But I gained a lot. And what I gained was a very good approach to the novel I was writing. I discovered that the characters in this book sat at my breakfast table, that they were in the house with me, that their situation seemed realer to me, closer to the core of the matter than they did when I thought about them at odd moments when there were other people around. So the big gain was creative. And I have come to believe that the more you can depart from the world, the better, perhaps, is the fiction that you contemplate.
My guest is Doris Grumbach. Her new memoir is called 50 Days of Solitude. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Doris Grumbach, and we're talking about the winter of 93, when she spent 50 days alone in her house in Maine. Do you know the feeling of both wanting time to pass slowly and pass quickly? Let me explain what I mean. I go through my typical week, and I go, as so many of us do, boy, thank God it's nearly Friday, and then I'll have a weekend. Then I say to myself, what the heck am I doing? Why, when I want life to go slowly in a way so I could live a long time and feel that life is long and spacious, why do I have this temptation to rush through every week just so I could get to the weekend? It makes you feel like you're doing the opposite of what you want to be doing. You're rushing your life instead of appreciating it moment by moment. So when you were alone, did you feel like, well, that day went quickly, that's good? Or did you feel, well, the day went slowly, that's nice, I have more time?
Well, Terry, I think it has a lot to do with the difference in our ages. Mm-hmm. You're relatively young, and there is that double action working in younger lives. You want to enjoy every moment that you can, so things go slowly, and on the other hand, you want it to happen fast. When you get older, or at least, let me say, when I got older, I tended to not want things to go quickly. So that fit very well with these days of solitude. The longer the day stretched out, the more I got to think about, the more I looked at, the more I listened to and read, the better it seemed. And at the end of this time, when I went back to Washington and then to the South for a vacation, I thought that things were moving far too fast.
Was there ever a time during your period of solitude when you said, oh, God, I have 3 more weeks left. I don't want to wait that long.
No. In fact, as I got close to the end, I wanted it to go on. And I realized how seductive this can be, that the benefits of it far outweigh the difficulties, and that for the rest of my life, whatever there is left of it, I will probably want it more and more.
Now, does that make you feel very secure? One of the things a lot of people fear is being alone, especially being alone when they get older. People who have spouses or companions, you know, worry terribly about losing them for a lot of reasons. One is because of how much they love them, but also there's this just fear of being on your own. Is that a fear you don't have now?
I don't have it. I would hate to lose my companion, but I know now that I can sustain myself. I want to add just 2 small things which make the condition of this experiment different from most people's time alone. One is that I saw the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
I have great, great pity for people who must face the rest of their lives alone. That was not my situation. And the second thing was that I live in a place of extraordinary beauty. From every window in my house, I see the sea. And that winter was an exceptionally beautiful time when the snow covered everything across the reach and over to Deer Isle, and I had this one enormous lawn stretching miles of white. I don't think if you lived in solitary confinement and looked at a brick wall for the rest of your life, or lived in jail, or lived in a very unpleasant place that you were forced to live in, that it would be the same. I was sustained in this by the beauty of the place that God granted me to have.
Do you think that you would have enjoyed this experiment when you were a lot younger?
I've wondered about that. I think when you're young, there are so many things working against it. You're so ambitious. You want to succeed. You want people to love you. You want the world to accept you. You work all the time at a kind of acceptance. When you get older, those things don't matter that much anymore. You know that you're not going to be loved by many people, and you will be loved by a few. You know that your career, as far as the active world is concerned, is over, and you're not going to be anything much more than you are right now. So solitude then becomes a kind of companion and not a violation of your ambitions as it was when you were young and people didn't call you or people didn't hire you or people didn't love you.
A couple of the questions you wanted to answer with your experience of solitude was, could you increase your creativity by cutting yourself off from the rest of the world for a while? And could you sustain yourself by yourself? And I guess the answer to both questions was, yeah, you could.
Yes, I think so. Of course, the book that came out of that is yet to be published, so
the novel?
It would be for the novel, but it would be for other people to say, you know, that it did help my fiction. It's very hard for me to say that, but that it did help me, and that there was enough there to keep me alive and happy, or as happy as I tend to be, which some people claim is not very happy. But for me, there was enough, yes.
For your 50 days, did you not talk on the phone with your companion?
We talked on rare occasions. Mostly we wrote letters, and I found that a fine thing, too. I think that when you write to someone rather than talk to them on the telephone, you tend to think more clearly of what you're saying, of what you choose to say and what you leave out, but at least you formulate it in the best prose you can. And that's very good practice for what you do as a writer.
But you're not having a conversation with somebody who you care about a lot. Didn't you miss that?
No. No, I don't. I I know this sounds terrible, but I never miss the telephone. I have no interest in the telephone at all. I love getting letters from people. I like writing back to them. But the sound of their voices in my ear is not something I relish.
Doris Grumbach, her new memoir is called 50 Days of Solitude. Our thanks to WNYC in New York. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing news from Haiti today, now that the military leader Raoul Cedras has left the country. Also, word about the Protestant Unionists in Northern Ireland accepting a ceasefire. That's a step undertaken already by the Provisional Irish Republican Army. News from Kuwait about Iraqi troop movements. And also from Israel and from the Gaza Strip, where the Palestinian Authority says it is trying to get Hamas, the militant Islamic group that opposes the PLO deal with Israel, to release Nachshon Waxman, the Israeli soldier they kidnapped.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Liz Phair's debut album, Exile in Guyville, was one of the surprise successes of 1993, selling over 200,000 copies. Now she's back with a follow-up called Whip Smart. Ken Tucker has a review.
I'm a firm believer in the sophomore jinx. In rock and roll, this is the notion that a pop musician can put out a great first album because he or she has spent years nurturing and refining material. But when it comes time for a second release, all the good stuff has been used up and self-consciousness has settled in. This happens all the time. That's why they call so many people one-hit wonders. Liz Phair's debut, Exile in Guyville, was itself such a perfect example of pop self-consciousness that I thought she was a goner. No way could she pull off the paradox of fresh jadedness two times in a row. Boy, am I glad I was wrong. Cinco de Mayo, Blowout Denial, I'm telling you, I was in immediate love with this music. Liz Phair is a truly original rock lyricist, creating patchwork lines that half make sense and then veer off into inspired stream of consciousness, with a choice vulgarity thrown into the bargain. She's not just breaking boundaries as a woman with an unusually candid approach to sexual matters, she's also unafraid to contradict one of rock and roll's most cherished myths, that the most authentic music comes from working-class underdogs. Liz Phair wears her Winnetka, Illinois upper-middle-class status like a badge of honor. The first cut on Whip Smart goes out of its way to tell us she went to summer camp with Julia Roberts without ever sounding like a stuck-up snob. But she's not a cynical smarty pants either. Listen to the lovely, realistic sentiments tucked into the title song.
I'm not.
There is in Liz Phair's confiding murmur of a voice the sound of an artist working at full strength, confident that she can put anything she wants into her work and trusts her audience to follow her. At a time when so many other rockers are refusing to be held accountable for any beliefs or feelings, Phair's cool-headed authority is a real kick.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Liz Phair's new album, Whip Smart. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.